Eric Edmeads. Welcome to the Maz Hakim podcast.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
It's such a pleasure to have you, Eric, because I've followed your journey for a while now because I was watching a lot of Mindvalley during COVID and I heard so much about your Wild Fit program. Can you take me back to that moment of when you decided to start Wild Fit and what was that aha moment for you?
I can. I would have to say there's two. There was the personal aha moment of I'm sick and I'm not feeling very good and doctors are prescribing drugs and surgeries and I don't necessarily want to keep going down a path that isn't working. And so at 21, I essentially decided to take charge of my own health and started experimenting with food and different things. And a month later, I'm 30 pounds down, 35 pounds down, and all my symptoms are gone. And so that was the first change, the first sort of moment where I'm like, okay, there's something going on here. In fact, I asked one of my doctors at that point how long he'd been in medical school, and he told me, 6 years. And I asked how much of that time he'd spent studying nutrition. And he kind of, it was an interesting question for him because the answer was none. Mm-hmm. And that was the first moment where I felt like I was in a plane and the pilot hadn't studied flying. Like, somebody better learn how to fly this plane.
Exactly.
And then the second one happened and it happened a few different times, but in particular, I had a couple of friends that saw what happened in my life and how I lost this weight and how I got out of pain and what have you. And they would ask me what I'd done. They're like, my God, what diet did you go on? And I'm like, I didn't. I just did this. And they would often take my advice for about 2 weeks or so. And they'd get really great results. And then the next thing you know, they'd be scarfing down some toxic dessert somewhere.
Yeah.
And they would just drift back. And that's what made me decide to figure out the transformative part of it. The nutrition part, look, there's any number of people who can tell you reasonably well what are good things to be eating and what not to be eating, and they can talk to you a little bit about metabolism. I mean, there's a lot of people in that area. But where I really wanted to differentiate was in the psychology piece for all the people who had tried to go on diets and had failed at them.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? Why do you think in the medical field there's just like a huge lack of knowledge on nutrition?
This will sound a little tinfoil hat conspiracy theory-like, and I don't think it's that there's any one particularly evil human being choreographing the whole thing, but at the end of the day, hospitals and medical schools need funding, and they get a lot of their funding from the pharmaceutical industry, and it's a lot more profitable to treat diabetes, as an example, for 30 years with pills and injections than it is to show somebody how they can turn it around in 8 weeks. And again, I'm not saying there's any one evil person sitting making that choice, but there's a giant machine. And that giant, well, there's a few giant machines. There's the giant food industry machine, which is driven by profitability, not by health.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the giant pharmaceutical machine, which is driven by profitability and not really by health.
Yeah.
And so, with those things misaligned, we're just headed in the wrong direction.
Do you think a lot of people are ignoring the fact that a lot of foods that we eat, the prepackaged foods, the foods with preservatives, MSGs, do you think they're ignoring it or is it just a lack of knowledge?
I think there's both. I think there are some people who are just completely ignorant that there's another way. They're basically like animals living in captivity. The zookeepers are feeding us, and we just feed on what they give us, and that's the way it is. But then you have to know there's another group of people who know something's wrong, and they're investigating all the time. They're trying to figure it out. They're going on this diet. They're going on that diet. They're reading this book. They're watching this movie, and the problem for a lot of those people is they just end up confused. And that's because there is so much confusing information out there. It's like there's the old expression about the man who has two watches never really knows what time it is.
Yeah.
And so the way most people are about food, well, 1 minute wine is good for you and the next minute wine is bad for you. And then food, in general, you should eat more of it. And then other people, no, you should eat less of it. And bread is good and bread is bad. And it just goes on and on. And so I think there's this next level of there are people who know or think they know, but they feel confused. And then you have people who basically do know, but they still don't do. And there's an old Chinese expression, to know and not to do is not to know, which means even if they do know, they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's where we really get into what the problems are. And the problems are a combination of a notoriously unethical food industry in terms of the way they market and the way they advertise their food. But then another problem, and that is that we have outdated instincts.
Mm-hmm.
And those outdated instincts drive us toward craving things that are not good for us because we now have things that are not good for us that match those cravings. things. A simpler way of putting that is it used to be a good idea to crave sweet things because fruit was rare and full of vitamins and it would suddenly get bright and ready and sweet and we'd eat it. And then it would go away. But now there's any number of things that we crave in the place of that instinctive craving, and those things are not so good for us.
So you spoke about your journey from severe illness to well-being. Can you tell me a little bit more about that journey?
Yeah, I mean, severe illness, I want to be clear. It's not like I was terminal or anything. Okay. I, you know, what I was dealing with was I had really significant throat infections and sinus infections. I had really serious cystic acne. I still have scars from, you know, from what happened. And then I also had really, really terrible digestive problems, terrible cramps that would be so painful that I couldn't even think when they happened. And I can tell you exactly what happened. Funny enough, is a friend of mine talked me into going to a Tony Robbins seminar. You know, I thought I was going to a sales seminar or something. And on the final day of the seminar, Tony Robbins shared a bunch of really fascinating things about food. And I thought, I don't know what this guy thinks he's talking about food. I've learned all the sales stuff, this marketing stuff, this, you know, all this good stuff, but now he's talking about food. But it was really compelling. And I decided that I would, you know, I was on this journey. I decided I'd try an experiment, the very experiment he recommended. He's like, you know, cut out some of this and add some of that. And I got to tell you, it wasn't slow. It was really fast. After 2 weeks, I was able to breathe through my sinuses for the first time in years without without some kind of inhaler or something. And also, you know, for people who have suffered with acne, they know that there's this difference between old acne and new acne. You know, you look in the mirror and go, I know about that spot. Oh, man, there's a new one.
Yeah.
But I had this, like, there were no new ones. After 2 weeks, it was only old ones. I'm like, okay, I know what that means. I could be clear. And a month later, I was completely clear. I was breathing through my sinuses. I'd lost so much weight. And I'll tell you what's funny is I weigh more now than I did before I lost the weight.
Wow.
But I wear it differently. Yeah. You know, so back then I was weighing in at about 185 pounds and I dropped down to 150 pounds or so, 155 or so. But what happened in terms of my look was that I went to go visit my mom. She was living in South Africa. And I took a girlfriend of mine with me and off we went. And we got to Johannesburg and got to the airport. We're coming down the escalator to the arrivals hall. And my mom looked straight at me and through me. She didn't even see me.
She didn't recognize.
She just straight and didn't even see me. But then she saw my girlfriend. My girlfriend had bright red hair. Sorry, I know, Robin. It's strawberry blonde. Strawberry blonde. I heard you the last time. It's red. It's red. But anyway, she had bright, bright hair. And so my mom saw her, and that caused my mom to do a double take and look at me. And then my mom realized it was me. And that's how much I had changed that my own mother didn't recognize me. And it wasn't just weight loss, you see, because a lot of times people think that the change is about weight loss, but it's actually about inflammation reduction. You know, most of us are eating either the wrong combination of processed foods or we're eating a lot of the plants that are really tough on us because there are a lot of plants that are tough on us and they're causing inflammation. And that inflammation often shows up in the bridge above the nose and around the eyes. And so my facial structure had changed sufficiently that my mom couldn't recognize me until she took another look. It was
a big
change.
That's crazy. So should different people eat differently or is it the same diet for everybody?
You know, I get that a lot, and it's a reasonable question in light of the blood type diet and the genome diet and all this kind of stuff. I think I can answer it best this way, and that is that there are, I think it's 13 essential vitamins, 16 essential minerals, 9 essential aminos, and of course all the healthy fats, and you need all of them. And I don't care whether you're from Australia, you need all of them. I don't care if you're an original Australia, you need all of them. I don't care if you're me, if you are a sapien, then you need those things.
Right.
Right? Now, so what that means is nutritionally, our requirements are incredibly similar to each other. So when somebody comes along and says to you, oh, you got to go on my special, you know,
keto,
all these, like this special you diet. This,
yes.
You know, by the way, it's incredibly good marketing. I mean, people's egos can, you know, the minute somebody goes, oh, I made this just for you, this is the you diet. You had your genome tested. You had your blood type tested. What I would say to you is that if you take the average, say, American, just to pick on America for a moment, but if you take your average American on the standard American diet and you put them on any of the blood type diets, they will get healthier. They will get healthier because at their core, they're all similar enough that they're removing the garbage, they're removing the processed food and getting you to focus on healthy stuff. So for the most part, No, we don't all need a separate diet. Now, there are some modifications to that, like your lifestyle and your environment would change things a little bit. Male and female is a little bit different. I would say that men's requirement for high quality protein might be higher than women's. Maybe, you know, throwing back to the reality that men did the hunting and probably ate a lot more of the protein. But then you know, another good example, if you're if you're living in say the United Kingdom, then you're going to need to change your lifestyle a little bit because you don't get enough sunlight there. So, you know, which means you're probably going to have a vitamin D problem. And so there are some environmental considerations within all of this. But at the end of the day, what is healthy for one person is healthy for the next person, you know, excepting for some allergies and that sort of thing.
What about in Dubai, for example, considering the environment, what do you think we should be eating on an average day?
Well, I think the answer is basically the same wherever you go. And the first answer is that question is flawed. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's flawed in the way that the diet industry has caused us all to be flawed, and the way the RDA in America has caused us to be flawed, and the way the USDA has. They've all tried to tell us that there's this recommended daily thing that you should be doing. Like in America, you've got the recommended daily allowance. That's a ridiculous notion. Our ancestors lived through seasons. And in one season, this food was available and this one was not. And so where's your daily allowance at this point? The truth is there are certain nutrients that we do require on a very regular basis because we can't buffer them. And there are other ones that you can eat and buffer for months at a time. Mm-hmm. And that's because our ancestors had to evolve to deal with food shortages and seasonal fluctuation of food.
Yeah.
Now, that said, I would say that anybody's diet that is heavily prioritized on high quality meat, fish, eggs, that sort of thing, and seasonally available largely old world fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, if they focus on those things, they're going to do well. And then, of course, there are some seasonal considerations like, you know, it's not a good idea to, say, eat the same vegetables all year round or even the same fruits all year round because, you know, our ancestors, again, had to live through seasonal fluctuation. Mm-hmm. So we're good at that.
Right. So let's talk fertility, for example, with men and women. A lot of people having issues, having children, perhaps because of the food that we eat, the stress, the environment. What would your message be to, say, a woman or a man experiencing fertility issues, and how can they change their diet or their lifestyle?
Yeah, that's a big one. You know, we now have like a whole sort of small army of wild fit children around the world because our clients have, many of them who've given up on having babies, have gone through the program and ended up pregnant, and to their own surprise, to their own shame. In fact, my favorite story about that, one of my earliest clients, his name is Kurt from Estonia. And I was actually in the audience at an event in Stockholm, and he was on stage speaking. And he's talking about his transformation. And the reason he's talking about it is that if you looked at pictures of him, you would see the before picture, he looks like a sick 45-year-old version. And in the present day picture, he looks like a healthy 22-year-old. Like he changed that much.
Yeah.
And so, of course, he's on stage speaking about that. But after talking about the change of losing all this weight and all this kind of stuff, he moves on and he starts talking about babies. I'll kind of do his accent a little bit, but and you have to understand with Estonians, they don't have he and she pronouns.
Okay.
how much simpler is that, you think? Especially these days.
Exactly.
You know, but
they, them, he, their, ziza.
So, but they don't have even he and she. Right. So when they speak English, they often get it wrong. So he goes, me and wife try get pregnant many years. We first have two babies, then 5 years, no babies. Some miscarriage, no babies, and every treatment possible, no babies. And then one day I do wild fit, and then I come home and my wife, he tell me he pregnant. And he tell me Eric's fault. I check Eric's schedule, Eric not in Stockholm 9 months ago, not Eric's fault. And no kidding, they named the kid Eric.
Wow.
And what had happened was they tried all the IVF, they tried all that stuff, they basically given up. But I'm going to suggest that sometimes, and this is a little politically sensitive, but I'm going to say it anyway, sometimes fertility problems are there for a reason. And that's a really tough thing to say, especially to that couple that so badly wants to have a baby. But the truth is, in some cases, there are people who are not paired up well, and they're probably just not meant to have a child. And I hate that that's true. But then on the other side, natural selection is coming along saying, hey, if you drink that particular drink and you eat those foods on a regular basis, maybe we don't want to pass that on. And so if you've arrived at a level where certain health markers are not where they're needing to be, it's going to get harder to have a baby. And here's a really good example. There's been a war on cholesterol for the last 30 years, you know, like you got to stay away from saturated fat. It's still doctors are still saying this. It's completely outdated. You know, what's crazy is you need cholesterol to make testosterone. Mm-hmm. Well, for the last 30 years, we've been frightening the hell out of people about saturated fat. And we've been getting people to push their cholesterol numbers down. Oh, simultaneously, in other news, testosterone levels are falling like crazy in men, and there's credible science out there suggesting that sperm count is dropping so low that by 2050, the average American man won't be able to conceive without medical intervention.
Oh my gosh.
It's scary.
It is really scary. So a lot of men and women, I mean, men in terms of testosterone, women and with hormonal like PCOS, have diabetes. What does that come down to?
Well, okay, we have to kind of divide diabetes, let's say, into two categories. There's obviously type 1, which is a very small minority of diabetic cases, and then there's type 2. And then type 2, you could subdivide into a variety of areas. I would argue that over the next couple of years, you'll start seeing some forms of dementia being referred to as type 3 diabetes.
Wow.
So, but let's say this. Everything that's not type 1 diabetes is, I don't think, should be reviewed as a disease. And this is a really important distinction. I think that when we view it as a disease, we miss the point. The truth is, I believe that it should be looked at as a repetitive stress injury. It means that we've been living the wrong way in the wrong season and triggering the wrong metabolic responses for so long that we've gotten out of balance and thereby ended up with sugar sensitivity or insulin, you know, sensitivity problems. And so once you recognize that, once you see it as an injury, then you go, well, okay, but it can be healed. And so as long as, I mean, look, at the end of the day, if somebody has type 2 diabetes for long enough, they can do irreparable damage to themselves. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
But if you catch it in the pre-diabetic stage or in the first few years of type 2 diabetes, it's fully reversible and often in under a few months. And I think we should really pay attention to that because if you think about it, it takes, say, a decade or two or three to create type 2 diabetes, but you can turn it around in a few months. That's how badly the body wants to be healthy, is that you can punish it for decades before it finally says, I can't handle this anymore. But if you treat it right for just a few weeks, it comes back.
And what about this notion of people being tired, so tired from a 12-year-old to a 60-year-old? Everyone's always tired. What are three things right now that someone can do, say, for example, from the moment they wake up to the moment they sleep to get that vitality and that energy back?
Yeah, so I think the biggest problem is that, you know, our bodies are capable of burning three different fuel sources. So, you know, we can burn sugar, and we can burn fat, and we can burn protein.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, the vast majority of the people that are living in the what we might call developed world these days, and even that's spreading, but the vast majority of people that are living in those countries are burning sugar as their primary fuel source. And that causes big ups and downs in energy. Mm-hmm. You're burning sugar and you're crashing and sugar and crashing and sugar and crashing. So this is where, you know, people wake up in the morning and they got to have a cup of coffee to get themselves out of bed, or they got to, you know, 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, it's time for a 5-hour energy or a cup of coffee or a chocolate bar or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because they're on the wrong fuel source.
Okay.
And the reason that they're on the wrong fuel source is that our food industry has so surrendered itself to the sugar industry that just about everything you eat has some form of sugar in it. I am shocked. If you go look at food labels, apparently I'm going to be on a I'm being interviewed by another organization which will remain nameless.
Yeah.
But we're going to be sneaking around a grocery store here in Dubai and looking at food labels and stuff, because you'd be shocked to find that not only is sugar in almost everything we eat, but it's often in the top three ingredients, which means that you're buying, say, tomato sauce, and sugar will often be the number two ingredient, which means that's like after tomatoes, then it's then full of sugar. And so the trouble is that your body, and maybe this is more metaphorical than purely scientifically accurate, but in a very real sense, your body acts as though sugar is a toxin. The minute you put it in, your body goes, Got to get rid of it. Got to burn it. Got to get rid of it right now. Burn it, store it, get it out of the blood. Because if you have too much blood sugar, you die. So your body is like prioritizing that heavily. So as long as you keep putting that in, your body's going to keep burning that, which means you're going to have these ups and downs, which is not only going to cause tiredness, but it's going to cause moodiness. You know, there are some people that on a monthly basis have sort of ups and downs with their emotional and mood states. Well, I got to tell you, that has a huge amount to do with having a messed up metabolism, and that once you flatten out your metabolism, then those moods go away, and you don't have to have those. You know, I don't know if you've ever had one of these, but the kind of mood swing I'm talking about here is where you're having an argument with somebody and you're saying nasty stuff to them, but there's a voice in the back of your head going, why are you saying that?
Yeah, don't say that. Don't say the next sentence, and then you just say it, and you're like, damn it.
That's sugar.
Wow.
That's sugar. I mean, it's also alcohol, we all know, right?
Yeah.
But it's also largely sugar. So one of the best things that people can do to fix that is to retrain their metabolism and be primarily fat burning, or at least fat burning for large chunks of the of say the month. And that changes everything. It changes your immune response, it changes your energy, it makes you younger, it helps you to sleep better, and it smooths out your energy in the course of the day. So that's thing number one. Mm-hmm. Thing number two is do enough physical exercise to actually sleep. Like one of the reasons people are tired is that they're not tired. And I know that sounds crazy, but this is what I mean. Tired really could be measured two ways. Mm-hmm. You could be mentally tired and you can be physically tired. And so if you are mentally tired but not physically tired, then what happens? Your body is twitchy all night and you don't drop into deep sleep in the same way.
Yeah.
But your mind is like, I'm so tired. I wish I could sleep, but I just can't. That's insomnia. You know, on the other hand, if you are like, say, mentally not tired, but you're physically tired, then you're lying there and your body feels like it's heavy and it's sinking into the bed, but your brain is going pop, 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 pop. But on the other hand, if you've had a cognitively demanding day and a physically demanding day, then that's the day when you lie down and you sleep properly and you wake up feeling better. And then the third thing has to do with energy management psychologically. And it kind of works like this. Mm-hmm. If you are passionately excited about what's coming tomorrow, you might have a hard time falling asleep because you're so excited. But when you sleep, you will sleep well. And the reason is your body's going, holy crap, we have a big day coming tomorrow. And it actually governs you to sleep better.
Mm-hmm. And is all sugar bad?
Well, that's a really great question. I my little girl and I talk about this quite a lot. You know, no, not all sugar is bad. There's good sugar and there's bad sugar. Mm-hmm. And there's also bad ways to eat good sugar. So, you know, I would regard that good sugar are the sugars that we've had a long evolved relationship with. And that would be naturally occurring fruit, naturally occurring sweet vegetables, honey. And that would be about it in terms of, you know, sugar rich things. But you have to remember that for our ancestors, those things were incredibly seasonal.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so you know, fruit was there, but it was green. Don't eat it while it's green. It'll make your stomach hurt. You learn that real quick. And then, oh, I think it's yellow. Oh, it's red and orange. Let's go get it. And then the minute you start eating it, what do you get? A powerful craving for more, because you want to make sure you eat all of it because winter's coming. So you have this cycle like that. But then when it's not there anymore, it's gone. And you might regret that. You might be sad about it, but it would be gone.
But it'd be gone.
And you wouldn't need willpower to stop. Right now, the food industry's caught on to that little sugar. And so they put sugar in everything because it stimulates your appetite. Look, if you're sitting having a meal with somebody and one person orders like a, let's say a cream linguine. You know, they've got their beautiful linguine there. And the other person orders, say, a grilled salmon and broccoli.
Yeah.
You want to bet who's going to order dessert? It's almost always going to be the person with the linguine. And the reason being is the linguine, the pasta, is ultimately sugar. It's carbohydrate-based. So what the carbohydrates do is they raise up your insulin levels and they trigger you to want to eat more carbohydrates so you're more hungry. Somebody who eats that grilled salmon and broccoli, it's just nutrition. Like it just goes in and you satiate. You're full and you're done. You know. So for a lot of us, what's going on is we're eating foods that actually make us hungry, which sort of defeats the purpose. And often it's the cheap garbage carbohydrates that do that.
And how does WildFit approach the psychological aspects when it comes to nutrition and diet today? Because especially, I mean, we see so much online and there's this turmoil of dieting and, like you said, trying different diets. How does WildFit approach that?
You know, first we have to take this approach that people don't fail diets. You know, and I've met people all over the world go, I failed my last diet. I failed every diet I've ever been on. Nobody has ever failed a diet. Diets fail people. Diets are constructed to fail. They're built to fail. I'll give you a perfectly good example. I'll give you a few. Somebody's on a diet. They're not supposed to eat chocolate. They eat chocolate. Now they have to go to confessional and they have to confess the chocolate. If they don't confess the chocolate, they feel guilt. Guilt is a food trigger, so guilt makes you eat. Now you go to the class or something and you confess your chocolate eating, and then they make you feel shamed about it. Shame is a food trigger. It makes you eat. So the entire diet industry, when it's based upon this idea of restriction, guilt, and shame, it's actually putting you in a food loop. It's designed to get you to fail. It's just meant to be that way. Mm-hmm. Now, the other problem is that most diets are built on calorie restriction, and they're built on a very old model of, you know, well, if you just burn more calories in the day than you eat, then everything's going to be okay. No, that's called starvation. Right? That's called starvation, and it's not good for you.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not suggesting that calorie restriction can't be good in certain times. We have a season that is meant for calorie restriction, but it is not a weight loss season. It's a cleansing season. A weight loss season is a season where you are eating in abundance. You're eating in abundance, but you're eating foods that tell you that it's okay to release fat now, that it's okay to release that weight. So WildFit takes a very different approach on two different methods or two different ways. One is that we are looking at seasonal metabolism. We're looking at humans' evolved ability to survive and utilize seasons, and then showing that to people and demonstrating it to them kinesthetically in their body so they get it. Mm-hmm. And then the next piece is that WildFit is built on something called behavioral change dynamics that I developed, which is a system of transformative education. And it's built on this kind of idea. Many of the teachers that I had in school clearly were of the opinion that learning was the student's responsibility, that all the teacher had to do is bestow great knowledge upon you and it's your job to soak it all up, right? I teach from a very different perspective. As a teacher, when I'm teaching, it is my belief that it is my responsibility to make the information sticky. It's my responsibility to get the student to learn it. Now, the very best learning relationship in the world is going to be a student who takes 100% responsibility for their learning and a teacher who takes 100% responsibility for putting it out in a learnable way. Mm-hmm. Then it's going to be fantastic. And that's what we've done with WildFit. So when somebody goes through WildFit, they go through a very staged process of psychological and nutritional changes that actually help them change their neurology. So they're not relying on willpower, or more to the point, they're using willpower the way willpower is designed. Willpower was not designed for somebody to sit and decide every few hours, should I, shouldn't I, because that always ends up in failure.
Do you intermittent fast?
Inside WildFit, we don't talk about intermittent fasting. And there's two reasons. One is that one of the principles of behavioral change dynamics is something we call minimum opportunities to fail. So if you want a student to, or a client to transform, then you have to do opposite to what most people or most training programs are doing. Again, most diets are built on damaging your self-esteem, right? You're on it, oh, you ate the chocolate bar, if only you were stronger. In other words, damaged self-esteem. WildFit is predicated upon building your self-esteem from the very beginning, from the start. And so as we do that, what's happening is that people are feeling better about themselves. And so now when they go to make a decision, they're making a decision as a stronger version of themselves. And then they make a supportive decision, and that helps them to feel better about themselves. Mm-hmm. So they're not really using willpower. They're actually changing themselves. They're transforming, which is why when you poll them a year later, they'll tell you, yeah, maybe I'm not doing everything 100% the way I was before, but I am on the right trajectory. I did not go back to the way things were before.
Can you share some tips on how someone can start living in a WildFit way today?
I can. I mean, you know, there are some principles to follow. The one is that your health is far more determined by eating enough of the good stuff than getting rid of the bad stuff. And so all these programs are out there like, get rid of these white foods, or, you know, don't eat that anymore. This is evil. And it's all about restriction and denial. All about restriction and denial. Well, restriction and denial, as we've just talked about, the diet industry has been operating on restriction and denial for ages, put somebody into a starving state, emotionally or physically, and what will happen? Binging. I mean, that's just going to be the response. So instead, what I would say is take a different approach, and that is prioritize that which you know humans need. We know that humans need, and excuse me, if people are vegetarian or vegan, I support them in attempting to go that route. But let's say somebody isn't vegetarian or vegan, then what I would suggest to them is we know this is ideal. Ethically raised, responsibly raised meat, fish, eggs, poultry, seasonal vegetables, seasonal fruits. Focus on those things. Get your nutritional needs met, and then oddly, a lot of the cravings go down. And I'll give you a taste of something really fascinating. In WildFit, we talk about the six hungers. There are six reasons that we eat.
Okay.
And only one of them is actually about nutritional hunger. The rest are faux hungers. They're not real, but they feel very real in your body. And as an example, one of them is called thirst. Now, that may seem odd that we'd call thirst a hunger, except that our ancestors got a huge amount of their water from the food they ate, you know, because no water bottles back then,
yeah.
you know, no pottery.
Yeah.
So they got their water by eating food that had water in it. And so they developed an instinct. And the instinct is, if I'm a little dehydrated, I'd better eat because I'm going to get water. Well, today people get a little dehydrated and then they eat. Well, they eat a bag of chips or get a Cinnabon, right? Like that doesn't have water in it.
Yeah.
And so they're not only not addressing the message they're getting, but they're amplifying the problem, which is going to make them even eat more. So if somebody were to prioritize staying hydrated, and this is the key right here, don't drink to address your thirst, drink to prevent it.
Uh-huh.
And if you drink to prevent your thirst, then a good chunk of your food calories go away, or your food cravings go away.
So what are three tips that you could give a woman listening now, or some tips on how to lead a healthier life?
Okay, so I think, you know, I hate to repeat anything, but the first one really is focus on eating good stuff. Eat all the bad stuff you want, but eat the good stuff first.
Okay.
Focus on getting your nutritional needs met. That's like absolutely number one. The next one is that move your body effectively. And this is very important because most of the movements we do are ineffective. You know, first of all, we don't move enough. We sit around just like you and I are doing right now. And
yeah.
We sit down. And I don't know if a lot of people know this, but the off switch to your brain is in your bum. You sit down and your brain kind of starts turning off, right? So moving around. So we talk about this. You know, there are three essential movements. You want resistance training. You really want that, especially when we're talking about going through your 30s into your 40s and your 50s, as your muscles want to, you know, your body will start giving up on muscle. So it's really important that you stress your muscles out. And even if you don't want them to go, just remind them that they're important.
Yeah.
So you got to have the strength training. And then you also want to have flexibility training. Getting old is a matter of losing flexibility, mentally and physically. So one of the very best ways of maintaining flexibility is to actually stretch and do yoga classes, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third type of movement is aerobic movement. And aerobic movement is highly, highly important to our heart and health, and lung health. So getting all three of those things in is vitally important. So that's two. And then what's the third one? Oh, for women particularly, I would say that for women, you know, sleep. Really, really sleep. Women need more sleep than men do. You know?
Really?
Yeah. And look, there's science that says it, but I'm just going to take it as an opinion. And an opinion that has come from reading and come from understanding, but also just from my own life, I've watched this, that, you know, my girlfriend and I can go to bed at exactly the same time and we can fall asleep at exactly the time. I'm going to wake up an hour and a half before her.
Mm-hmm.
And I just do every day, if not a little bit more. And I have to admit, and Kirsty, if you're listening, I'm really sorry about
this. Sorry, Kirsty.
But I have to admit, there was a time when I regarded it as laziness. And frankly, I should offer an apology to every one of my ex-partners that I thought were being lazy. Because more recently, I've read that that's actually a genuine thing, that women experience greater happiness when they get that fuller night of sleep. And it's usually about an hour longer than men. And so I would say that's the third tip. And then, wait, we have to have some tips inside that.
Yes.
What does it mean? Like, how do you get that sleep? Well, first thing is mentally, physically tired. Make sure that you use your brain and use your body. If you do not use them heavily in the day, you won't be tired enough to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing is turn off all the screens 2 to 3 hours before you go to bed. Third thing is don't eat anything 3 or 4 hours before you go to bed.
Okay.
Just don't do that. I can give you a good reason for it, but you make your own human growth hormone, but if you produce insulin, you just break it down.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get to do any good healing that night. Dark room, cool room, do those, and gratitude meditation about the excitement meditation about the day ahead.
Okay.
If you put all that together as a recipe, I think you sleep real well.
And what about for men? What are some tips on how men can lead a healthier life?
You know, obviously there's some really similar things. I think that I'll say the same thing is about get your nutritional needs met. But I would say this, and it's true for women too, but really men, like prioritize good quality protein. And then I'm going to say for men on the second one, yeah, all three forms of movement are important. But for men particularly, you can start getting into your 40s and you start, you know, people start talking about testosterone and muscle wasting and that kind of stuff. Go to the gym and lift and lift and lift and lift. I thought I understood this, but I can tell you that I am heavier in muscle today than I was when I was 48.
Wow.
And I'm now 53. And that's because I technically, statistically, it goes the other direction, right? After your late 40s, you start losing muscle. I gained muscle all through that period. And I've worked hard at it. And I got to tell you, it's improved my posture. It's improved my way of being. Remember that excessive fat is not only excessive fat, but it's also an organ producing estrogen. So, you know, and leg exercises really stimulate the pumping of testosterone. Mm-hmm. So as you get older, these things are really important. And then, you know, the third thing that I would say for men, and, you know, I don't know a better way to say this, but it's like, allow yourself to be aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean aggressive with the people around you. You know, I mean, like, go study a martial art or take on a team sport that lets you really get to know who you are.
Be masculine.
To really step in your masculinity. You know, there's this new idea, this new masculinity is a man who doesn't experience aggression. And I'm like, no, not at all. Real masculinity is somebody who's capable of incredible aggression, who's capable of violence, but doesn't use it.
Yeah.
And is able to control it. And I got to say that, and I'm sorry if this is like wildly stereotypically, you know, sexist or what have you, but if a couple's walking down the street and, you know, some bad people come along, I think you want to be with a man who's capable of aggression.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that the woman shouldn't also be capable of defending herself. And frankly, my little girl's doing jiu-jitsu right now.
Yeah.
So I think that for men, it's more than just that safety on the street thing. There's something about
innately
that masculine energy and self-esteem and testosterone production. I think it's really important.
Do you think men are becoming less masculine nowadays because of the
I think
food?
That becoming less masculine is somehow becoming fashionable. And so, yeah, there are people who are attempting to become fashionable in that sense. It's like this idea of toxic masculinity is just... you know, I was having a debate with somebody on Twitter a few months ago, and they were talking about toxic masculinity. I said, can you name for me the features of toxic masculinity? But I want you to make sure that not one of them could be used to describe women either.
Okay.
Like, what we're really talking about is toxic behavior.
Yeah.
And women are capable of toxic behavior, and so are men.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the toxic behavior and then not slander masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I enjoy Jordan Peterson and his talks on, I mean, you know, he and I did an event in Mexico together a couple of weeks ago, and I got to go on a private library tour with him, just him and me.
Oh, wow. Jordan Peterson.
With Jordan. He was such a gentleman. He's an incredible guy. I already admired him, but more so now. But, you know, the way he talks about this, it's like, you know, let's not forget 99% of bricklayers are men, a direct quote from him. Well, you know, masculinity has done some good things. And yeah, there are also people who have done some bad things in the name of masculinity, but I think we can say the same thing for women. Why make it a gender thing? And let's get rid of toxic behavior and let's reward good, healthy, you know, good, healthy femininity and good, healthy masculinity.
Yeah.
That's what we really need.
Which I think a lot of people are swaying away from. There's very gray areas now.
Well, once you label something toxic masculinity, now you've got this generation of kids that are growing up going, oh, so if I hold the door open, is that toxic masculinity? And you know, look, I know women in both camps. I know, like, I've spent a lot of time in Scandinavia, and I got to tell you, as a man, if you offer to lift a woman's bag up into the hold on the plane, and you do that in Scandinavia, you're playing with your life.
She gets offended.
She could. And by the way, it's generational. If she's over 40, there's a really good chance she's going to get offended. It's like men and women in Scandinavia, they're like, you know, don't do that. And by the way, I don't completely disagree with the notion. If you think about this, if you lift the heavy bag for women their whole lives, then you've just robbed tremendous opportunities for their own strengthening. So I understand that. Mm-hmm. I get that desire. But I also see the other side of it, where, you know, there are women who enjoy that, the sort of traditional gender roles, and like it when a man holds the door open for them. Here's the difficult part for men. I would put to you that men have to walk a very, like, very thin line. And on one side of the line is chivalry.
Yeah.
And on the other side of the line is chauvinism. And man, you got to walk it carefully. And you do. You walk a little too far this way, you're wimpy. Nobody wants to date you. You walk a little too far this way, you're getting canceled all over the place. And worse than that, the line moves. It's not this straight line that once you've perfected it. No, yeah. What was like, okay, let's talk about Sean Connery for a moment. I mean, it, you know, all you have to do is listen to a couple of his interviews. Today, he'd be canceled all day long. Yes. I mean, he would never make it 5
or
minutes.
Or his movies.
Watch any of his James Bond movies. They're basically a lesson in misogyny. But that was chivalry back then. And so that line is shifting and moving all the time. And our job is to shift and move with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that the generation that's coming up now have been given a nearly impossible task because the line is shifting so quickly and rapidly under their feet that they just don't know who to be.
And it was attractive back then. You know, with age, I think I have realized that I need to sort of, and I'm doing this more and more, becoming less, I don't know, like stepping more into my femininity and allowing that, you know, I think growing up, you have this idea of you have to achieve and do this and do everything yourself. But then you forget, actually, you know, innately, that's not really your prime, I guess, desire, you know, and that can be a little bit controversial as well. But, you know, I'm allowing myself to sort of step in a lot more into my femininity and my feminine roles and being okay with that.
Yeah. And, you know, so I'm working on a book at the moment that'll be out later this year, and it's called The Evolution Gap.
Yeah.
And the book, basically, I'm putting forward a theory. And the theory is that there's a gap that's opened up between our very, very, very slow pace of genetic evolution and our unbelievable capacity for innovation and accelerated innovation. Mm-hmm. And so as we've constantly innovated the planet, to make life easier, to make food more secure, what have you, we've moved further and further away from our instincts. And that's a tricky thing. And so the fact that I even watch you feel a little bit nervous about saying, I'm going to allow myself to step, because you're waiting for the people on Twitter to go, what are you talking about?
But, what do you mean?
Yeah, but like you immediately, the hardcore, the militant members of any movement will jump on you really quickly. But I would suggest this, that I'm a fan of individual liberty. I'm a fan of people living the lives that they want to live. Mm-hmm. And what I would say is that the closer your life aligns with your instincts and your natural proclivities, generally speaking, the happier you're going to be. Mm-hmm. And so if you feel more comfortable living what you consider to be a more feminine lifestyle, and say that means being in a relationship with a more traditionally masculine man, and say that means letting him hold the door open for you, if you're both getting fulfillment from that, then I am with it 100%.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. I want to talk about stress for a second. How do you unwind after a long, stressful day? Is there a particular ritual that you do or anything you suggest?
Yeah, I have a number of different mechanisms for that. And the first thing is just reality. And the reality is that we currently live in the safest, easiest, most secure times in the history of Earth. And so what anybody is stressed about is beyond me. And when I get stressed about something, I have to remind myself. And I just want to put this in perspective. I think Harari says this in Sapiens. He's like, if you think back to 150 years ago, if you were a carpenter and you were drafted into the military or you enlisted or what have you, if they knew you were a carpenter, you might think they'd send you off to the construction or engineering division. But no, what they would do is send you to the medical corps. And the reason they would send you to the medical corps is because 150 years ago, the slightest wound resulted in amputation, because that's how terrified people were of infection, because nobody had invented antibiotics yet.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't sound shocking enough, it's also important to remember that they also hadn't invented anesthetics. So all of these amputations are being done without pain killing. Now that's only 150, 200 years ago. We live in the safest, best times ever. You can walk on almost any street without having any fear. You know you're going to eat today. You have a roof over your head. No generations have had the kind of safety that we have, and yet we're stressed.
So stressed.
So that's the first thing, is to wake up into the reality that we are living in the best times ever, okay? So, okay, now beyond that, okay, we still get stressed about stuff. Mm-hmm. So then what can we do? Well, I love what Wayne Dyer used to say about this. He used to say, everything you worry about, stress about, can fall into two categories. There are things that you can do something about, and there are things that you can't do anything about. So if you can do something about it, well, get off your butt and do something about it. And if you can't do anything about it, then let it go. Let it go. And if you think about what that kind of stress or that kind of worrying about is about, it's about reminding yourself to worry about it. Yeah. That's what it is. It's like, oh, you forgot to worry. Oh, you forgot to worry. You know what? You take out a journal. I keep one on the bedside table. Mm-hmm. I start worrying about something. I write it down. I just write it down. And you know what's weird? My brain goes, oh,
Okay. You've addressed it.
You've addressed it. We can wake up and read it and worry about it again in the morning. Yeah. And that goes away. So that's one way, is to just journal what's going on your mind so that your mind doesn't feel compelled to keep popping it up for you. Because that's that stress loop, right?
Yeah.
Then the next thing is meditation. And again, I got to go to Deepak for this, or actually Wayne and Deepak. Yeah. I remember Wayne Dyer telling this story. He said he was having a horrible, horrible event. You know, something was very, very difficult in his life. And he called Deepak. And this is the way Wayne tells the story. So this is Wayne, me doing Wayne, doing Deepak.
Okay. But,
so Wayne says, Deepak, I've got a really serious problem. Meditate. No, Deepak, it's Wayne. I know about meditating, Deepak. It's just, I've got a serious problem. Meditate. Deepak, it's Wayne. I know about meditate. Meditate and call me back. And then, of course, Wayne doesn't call him back because he went and meditated. And then Deepak calls him, you know, a couple weeks later and says, so how's that thing? And he goes, what thing? That thing you were so, he goes, I don't even remember.
Wow.
And what I want to say is that a lot of times stress is just a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a pattern. And so going into a deep meditation, and listen, I know there are purists out there that are like, well, if you're not sitting in, you know, with your legs crossed and incense burning and crystals around your neck, then it's not meditation. Look, running can be meditative. Swimming in the ocean can be meditative. There's all kinds of things that can be meditative. But what we've killed in the last couple of years with our social media devices is we've killed thinking time.
Yeah.
You know, a few years ago, about 6 years ago, my cell phone, along with almost everything I owned, was stolen. And I replaced a lot of the things that were stolen, but the one thing I didn't replace back then was my cell phone. And I lived for 6.5 months without one.
Wow.
6.5 months without a phone. The only reason I got one in the end was that my wife got pregnant and I felt it irresponsible to be not having a phone in my pocket.
Not contactable,
you know? Yeah. But I went 6.5 months. And you know what was really weird? Now I'm walking through airports and malls and I feel like, I don't know if you've ever seen one of these like sci-fi horror type things where it's like, everybody's drinking a lot of water.
Yeah.
Something's happened. Have they been possessed?
Yeah.
Well, that's what happened to me. I'm walking around. I'm going, oh my God, everybody's looking at their phones all the time. Most people don't even know this is going on anymore because they're so busy looking at their phones that they don't see that the other people are doing it.
Yeah.
When I gave up my phone, I felt like Earth had been possessed. Oh. It was like, and you know, we can talk about all the different impacts that this is having. And funny thing about, well, it's not the least bit funny, is that suicide rates typically go down during times of global stress. Like suicide rates went down during World War I, and they went down during the pandemic, except for teenage girls. There they continue to rise, and they continue to rise because of social media. We can talk about all the different issues that we've got with social media, but here's just one. We used to have thinking time. If you were at the doctor's office, you could read the 8-year-old magazines that were sitting there, or you could think. If you were sitting waiting for the plane, you would think, or how about this? Now, this is going to be very shocking for our younger listeners.
Yeah.
But there was a time when we used to get on planes and there were no devices.
Nothing.
None. Like you had to sit there for 12 hours.
With all the smokers.
With the smokers. Thinking. And so what I want to suggest is that one of the reasons that we're experiencing this artificial level of stress during the time in history that has been the easiest to live is that we aren't giving our brain downtime.
There's a famous Buddhist saying that the biggest hurt and cause of hurt for humans is they don't allow themselves time to sit down and think.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the pandemic did. And that's why, you know, a lot of people struggled. Eric, I could talk to you for hours. Where can we follow you? Where can we sign up for WildFit?
Well, I manage my own Instagram account. I'm probably a bit crazy, but that's me, at Eric Edmeads.
Okay.
I'm also at www.eric.ee, my initials. And but WildFit is at getwildfit.com. And there's even a really cool, like, 2-week trial version that people can do right from there just to put their toes in the water. And it's transformative.
Right. It's been such an absolute pleasure and so fascinating.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.